I think a lot of people have gotten used to this hybrid work from home, work from the office balance, and many thought that would be here forever. Obviously, time will tell, but certainly in the tech world, I think everyone thought, well, they're going to be the last people to have people come to the office 5 days a week. Tom Gimbel joining us right now. He's a job expert, founder of the LaSalle Network, and Tom, when Amazon's even bringing people back 5 days a week in the tech world, that might be a signal of bigger things to come, huh?
I think there was a country song once, John, "Nothing Lasts Forever."
Right, yeah.
So I think what we've lost sight of is what the definition of a technology company is. If you're not a manufacturing company, people think you're not technology, but you could have a huge development crew. And I think when you're a company like Amazon that's in so many different verticals, what it shows is that, you know, the biggest and the smartest and the brightest companies in the world believe that there's a lot to be said for collaboration and people being together. And it just took a little bit of time and a little tick up in unemployment and some uncertainty in the economy to allow people the freedom to be able to make the decision. But it's going to come back this way.
Do you think that there's a way to do it instead of just saying you're back 5 days a week and no excuses, no nothing? You could, to maybe offer a chance for people, tell people, yeah, I want you here 5 days a week, but still maybe carry over a little of the, maybe leniency is not the word, maybe the understanding of the complexities of the work-life balance that we've learned a little bit during the pandemic, and extend that to people understanding for, you know, doctor's appointment, picking up kids from school. Like, keep some of the flexibility that we had learned while still asking people to be there 5 days a week if at all possible.
I think that exists. I really do. Do I believe that there's companies that don't do it? I do. Mm-hmm. But do I believe there's employees that take advantage of it? I do. And I think it's a two-way street. But yeah, I think majority of companies are going to give, you know, the week of Thanksgiving or Christmas or the 4th of July, they're going to say to work remote. And if you're, you know, certain situations like that, if your kid's sick or extenuating circumstances, but all in all, the mantra is really going to be, we need you in the office and you need to be here. And if employees aren't going to line up for that, they're going to find people that will. And the people that aren't in the office, I mean, Amazon's saying this for January 1. So they're giving people a 4-month head start to arrange it. And, you know, to work from home, you know, and having daycare and doing those things, you should be having that anyways. You can't be a full-time parent and a full-time employee. And those are the challenges that people face. But the world actually handled itself pretty well before 2020.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to remember that for, you know, the first couple centuries of work, we were expected to be in the office 5 days a week. And I think there's going to be kind of like this adjustment period. For some listeners, they're like, I've already been in the office for 5 days a week for a long time, or
yep,
I never got to not be. My brothers are firefighters. I know a lot of first responders out there listen too.
Correct.
Like, they've already had this world. So I think a lot of people are actually kind of happy that other people are being brought in 5 days a week, although the traffic's still terrible. But anyways,
I don't think the traffic's ever going to be good again, John. But
yeah,
but the reality of it is there's been this white collar bias during the recession that I personally think is unfair. And we had the cashiers at the grocery store and Walgreens and the truck drivers and the factory workers and the fruit pickers and everybody else that was going in. And people say, well, if your job can be remote, you know, whenever people say that, they're discounting the fact that what's good for the individual isn't always good for the company. And I know you're a hockey guy, and I just tweeted this out today. Remember what Herb Brooks said? I don't need the best players. I need the right players.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's too often that people think you need to have exceptions made for people. And the best players don't usually want the exceptions. They want to work. They're the hardest workers there are. And the idea to commute, and if the commute's too long, you'll need to have to find a job closer to home. Working remote is now going to be on a list of preferreds, not a mandate.
Yeah.
And if you want to do it, you'll probably have to take less money.
Yeah. And as employers gain the upper hand again, like you mentioned, that uptick in unemployment, you know, as the threshold or the who has the hand or the leverage shifts back, that certainly has changed. 847 text it in. Thank Tom Gimbel for being on the radio. He always has great insights. Tom, consider yourself thanked, okay?
I'll take it, John.
Yeah, he's excellent. He's a job expert, founder of the LaSalle Network. Tom, when I was in high school, roughly around the turn of the century, which sounds way older than it is, 2000, 2002 is when I graduated. And, you know, obviously this is part of my, you know, privileged or however you want to call it, upbringing, you know, middle class. It was the expectation that I was going to college. How well I did and where I got, which one I went to was all up for grabs, but it was just the expectation. And I'm grateful for that. But that sea has shifted a little bit amongst teens and maybe in a very welcome direction. Not that college is bad, but it may not be and doesn't have to be for everybody.
Well, the one challenge with that, I agree with you, John, and I had a similar upbringing. The challenge that we face is if you don't go to college out of high school or maybe after a gap year, it's really hard to go back in your mid-late 20s or 30s.
True.
And obviously people do it, but it's a challenge. And it's kind of like working out in the morning. Get up and go get it and get it done. And what's happened is, not necessarily starting out as a bad premise, but some people went to college, whether it was online universities or the push to take out student loans when interest rates were cheap and it was easy to do, and now people are saddled with it. And those students didn't graduate, or they got degrees that aren't practical. That's really the challenge. And do you need a degree today? No, you know what? If you're a computer programmer and your brain works like that, no, you might not. However, you can't just say, I want to be a computer programmer, I'm not going to college, and then be good at it. That's like saying, I want to be a doctor. Everybody can't do that. And college gives you a really good foundation if you go and you focus on learning and how to solve problems, how to work in a collaborative environment, and you learn how to work through complex situations. I still think it's a positive if people want to invest in themselves.
Right. I'm just surprised the number. So about 49% of high school students, or teen even younger, 13 to 18, they believe a high school degree, trade program, two-year degree, or other type of enrichment program is the highest level of education needed for their career path. So just about half. 56% believe that real-world and on-the-job experience is more beneficial than obtaining a higher education degree. I guess that's what I'm surprised about. These are the kids themselves saying this. I guess you're right, Tom. It's about like lining up what you actually think you might want to do, where you want to do it, how much it costs, and having that conversation on the front end and what that degree is and is that worth it in the long run? Because, I mean, that's ultimately what it comes down to, is that you can go and get a job immediately, not have the debt, and build a pretty sustainable career with some pretty high incomes if you work hard and you do it that way. But there's still a gap between four-year college degree jobs and not. So you just need to arm teenagers, I imagine, with all that information and then kind of make a decision as a family from there.
Yeah, well, I think you said that how you ended it is very interesting, John, as a family. And the challenge is, number one, not every kid comes from a two-parent family. Number two, not every parent is an educated adult, meaning that they don't understand it, and they may, A, encourage the kid to do it for the wrong reasons or discourage a kid to do it for the wrong reasons. And so I think this is kind of a hot button for me because I'm on the board of a group called of a charity. I don't want to be a proselyte, but I think that helps inner city youth, and the most formative years for a child in education is the first 5 years. It's when the brain is formative and what happens. One of every four children is born into poverty. Okay? So if you've got a poverty family that doesn't have the right education, the right job, the right diet, the right food, the right structure, we've got 25% of our kids that are growing up there, and they may be either A, think they can't get into college, or shouldn't because the cards are stacked against them. And then when you get into high school, we don't teach kids about the jobs that are they could go for. And there's not enough focus on the development of what they need to do to make a living. So college, whether it's good or bad, kids aren't able to make an educated decision unless they come from a middle or upper middle class. They don't really get it. And that's a real challenge that we're facing in America. And unfortunately, the politicians and the leaders don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, there is a disparity of how that conversation is even framed amongst families. I think that's a fair point, right? Is that if every kid had the equal opportunity to at least have that discussion in a proper way, okay. But you're pointing out that it could be cyclical, that where families where college wasn't featured or shown as an option, as a good, strong option from a young age, you're going to repeat the cycle.
There's there's a shortage of police officers, right? There's nothing wrong with going into the police academy, becoming a policeman, and doing that, and being part of a union, and getting a pension, and working, and an early retirement, quite frankly, for a lot of people. And that works. And there's other people that we live in a society now where people say, you know what, I wouldn't want to be a policeman anymore. It's a thankless job. That wasn't the way it was when you and I were growing up. Yep. Then you have people who are tradesmen, and you have plumbers or contractors, and they don't want that for their children necessarily because they don't want them on doing manual labor when they're 60 years old to make ends meet, and what happens there. So it's just, and other people say, you know what, that's what makes me happy. I like being outside. I want to be dealing with people. I don't want to be in an office. And it's a totally great way to make a living. The problem is you come out of the gates hot out of high school making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year as a tradesman, but you cap out at, you know, whatever that is, $100,000, $120,000 a year with overtime, so which is a great living, well above poverty level at $31,000. But it's a trade-off. And do you want to go and rack up $80,000 in student loans? It's a really long, nuanced, detailed, complex conversation that longer than a radio segment, but really longer than most families give it credit.
For sure. Tom, great insight. We were going to talk about the three worst office jargons that annoy coworkers. I'll share that in the 1 o'clock hour with our listeners. I know you'll be listening, Tom. And actually, we're getting a lot of texts and calls about this college or no college discussion. Maybe we'll have some time in the 1 o'clock hour. I'd love to get some people's feedback on that, whether that is an expectation that you set or that should be set for kids to go to college, or if a more long-term discussion is necessary. Tom Gimbel, as always, we appreciate your time. The listeners do too. Take care, my friend, okay?
Absolutely. Only a month until hockey season, Joe.
Oh, man. We got preseason next Wednesday, buddy. See you at the United Center.
Talk to you soon.
Take care. Now, the last time I saw Dennis Rodkin in person, he was wearing a suit, not a suit, but a button-up with a tie, and we were both riding a stick and pony around the WGN television parking lot for our competition.
Because we're serious journalists,
Joe. We were part of the, what are they called, the Olympics at WGN.
It was an
did.
Olympics gig, yeah. I was there to do my segment, yes. So I was wearing a tie and riding a
I saw you in the
pony.
Green room. I think it was Lauren Lapka looked over and they're like, why is that guy wearing a tie? He can't be here for this. He was. It was a lot of fun. We posted all of it at WGNradio.com. Dennis Rodkin, I feel like this is like the white whale. The
it is.
Sale
Absolutely.
Of the Michael Jordan house. It's here.
It is. Do you know, I've been covering the Michael Jordan house since 1991. And so today's news, yesterday's news, is like a culmination.
So now you can retire?
Are you telling
no,
me to?
No, this is big news. I mean, really.
It is.
Every
it
couple
is.
Of years, I feel like you check in on it because there's either a price reduction or something. So walk us through it.
So Michael Jordan's home, which has been for sale since February 2012, this past weekend, went under contract to a buyer. It's a contingent contract, so it may not close, but this is the closest to selling it's been since February 2012. Jordan and his then-wife, Juanita Vannoy Jordan, built the house in the early 90s. In 2006, when they divorced, he got custody of it, or he got ownership, I should say, of it. In 2012, he put it on the market, February 29th, 2012, taking advantage of the idea of Leap Day and Michael Jordan's leap, he put it on the market at $29 million.
Wow.
Later, by the time it went under contract Sunday, the price was down to $14,855. Those digits add up to 23, which is his jersey number. And it's under contract. All I know at this moment is that it's under contract because the real estate agent listing it is ethically bound to withhold what the sale price will be. I'm pretty sure it'll be close to that asking price, but I don't know anything. Mm-hmm. Don't have any confirmation. Can't tell us who the buyer is. All she would say is that it's an end user, which probably means it's not a developer who's going to tear it down. But all she would say was it's an end user. So the rest of that sentence is my supposition based on it. It's pretty amazing that after 12 and a half years, it's 12 years and 6 months that it has been on the market, and it's been the subject of everybody's jokes and speculation and why won't he drop the price further and all those sorts of things. Finally, now in the hands of the same agent it's been in the hands of for 12 and a half years. Whoa. It's under contract.
14.855, those digits add up to 23. They also add up to a little more than half of the price that it was originally listed for.
They also add up to about $10 million more, about $8 million more than anyone has ever paid for a home in that part of Highland Park. His house is about 3 miles from the lake, from Lake Michigan. Over there, west of Highway 41, the highest price, and there's only been one, is about $6 million. Generally, you don't see sales over $3 million in that part of Highland Park. Over on the lake, where he is not, there have been sales at the $10 million level.
I will say this, when I scroll through pictures of the Jordan house, I kind of get why it didn't sell. It definitely needs some work to bring it out of the 90s, for sure.
Yeah, it looks very 1990s. They built it. So, you know, he's a rising megastar on the Bulls in the early 90s. They built there because the Berto Center, where the Bulls practiced, had just opened. And, of course, since then, the Bulls have moved back downtown to practice. But they were practicing in Deerfield, about a 10-minute drive away from this site. He and his then-wife, Juanita, build this castle, this colossus for the two of them and their three kids, possibly other hangers-on. It's about a 56,000-square-foot house.
Jeez!
14-car garage. Ugh. Full basketball court. Really interesting swimming pool. It's essentially a loop with current. So you can, it's like an
endless like a lazy
loop.
River?
Yeah, basically. It's a really remarkable house. But yeah, when you see the interior, it looks like the 1990s. Real dark wood, leather padding. It has not been updated to 2024, but you know, the family apparently hasn't lived there since around 2012 or earlier.
How much do you think that they paid in property taxes in those years of just sitting there? Not that he doesn't have the money, but...
Funny you should ask, John. As you said, you know, on anniversaries, I've written about this, and when he had when the property had been on the market 10 years... 2.5 years ago, I added it up, and he had paid over $1 million, about $1.1 million, just in property taxes in the years the home had been for sale.
Shout out to the Highland Park schools benefiting from that, from no one living there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Wow. Well, okay. Well,
and don't forget, his kids never, even though he was paying property taxes in Highland Park, his kids didn't go to Highland Park schools. They went to Bannockburn schools in the community next door, partly for security reasons. They were smaller schools.
Okay. All right. Well, that's interesting. Well, obviously, you'll keep us posted and John posted when it closes so
when
we can
get closes,
the price.
Yeah.
We'll squeeze out a couple more stories out of it before it's all said and done.
Exactly.
You're
going to
lose it for a little bit. This is a cool story about the former President Barack Obama and his wife, Michelle. Before they lived in their house, they lived in a condo in Hyde Park, and that condo's up for sale, right?
It is. They lived there from the early 90s till 2005 when they bought the house that everybody is familiar with, the one on Greenwood, from which they moved to the White House. But they sold this one when moving to Greenwood. They sold it to a musician, Kurt Elling, a jazz musician, and his wife. And now it's for sale for the first time since the Obamas sold it. The Ellings lived there for a few years, then they moved to New York. And a really interesting sort of connection is after they buy the house, they don't know the Obamas, though Elling has performed at Obama events. They don't know the Obamas, but they go to the first, or Elling Kurt Elling performs at the first Obama state dinner. And what he told me last week is Michelle Obama says to her husband, "Honey, you know Kurt. He's the man who bought our house." And President Obama says, "Yeah, I have a memory too." It's just my favorite story. Elling also talks about Barack Obama, who at the time has just been elected to U.S. Senate when they've moved and the Ellings are buying the house. Barack Obama is the one who comes back to the townhouse, or the condo, I should say, to say, you know, this drawer sticks and here's how to make that door, because it's a 1920s building. And at the time, of course, nobody knew the man would become president. But now Kurt Elling can say a former president showed me which drawers stick. I'm sorry. I said they moved to New York and they've held on to it as a rental since moving to New York. They have moved back to Hyde Park, but to a different location. And they're now putting this up for sale after having renters in it for about a decade.
Is this the with the green fireplace, tile
yes.
fireplace that Michelle Obama had a big portrait done in, right?
Yes. It's a that was a portrait done in Chicago Magazine
yeah.
when he was not yet in the U.S. Senate, or maybe he was running for Senate. And we used that picture in the story because I am still friends with the photographer, Katrina Whitcamp, who shot it for Chicago Magazine. And that fireplace is still in the property. It still looks pretty much as the Obamas left it, but that's sort of the most distinctive because there is this portrait of Michelle in front of it.
Cool stuff. All right, well, we're going to keep Dennis Rodkin right where he is. Got a couple more questions for him about some stories. But first, let's get a look at the Wintrust Business Minute. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A new lawsuit accuses Steak and Shake of violating Illinois' biometric privacy law. The complaint says the restaurant chain violated the privacy rights of customers with new ordering kiosks that scan a user's face. Steak and Shake is headquartered in Indiana but has locations across the country. It installed the new kiosks earlier this year, allowing customers to place orders, pay for food, and access their loyalty accounts. The lawsuit says the facial geometry of a customer face is collected during the process, violating the Illinois Biometric Information Privacy Act. That law protects facial, fingerprint, and iris scans. Companies are required to get consent before collecting that data. The lawsuit seeks class action status. A Chicago company working on stem cell therapy technology has raised $15 million to advance its efforts. Syntax Bio is an offshoot of an incubator at the University of Illinois Chicago. Cranes reports the startup is developing technology based on CRISPR, a process of gene editing. The technology controls when certain genes are expressed and enables the development of methods used to transform stem cells into other cells. The finished product can be used as cell therapies for certain diseases. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
All right, Steve Alexander with the business of food.
Yeah, thank you, and I did it again. I broke into the Bob Surratt Oldies Vault. Remember this one?
Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
Yeah, I'll let you try to guess who's singing that and in what year while we talk about a man in Sublette, Illinois who was, well, he is a lucky man.
He is.
What happened after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today? There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. It's a big week up and down the country roads of Illinois and America.
National Farm Safety and Health Week.
And one of the most common ways that farmers are still getting into trouble, and this is frustrating because there have been a lot of warnings, is inside grain bins.
A man became trapped inside a 25-foot bin.
That was 2 weeks ago on a farm near Sublette, about 2 hours west of Chicago.
When the crews arrived, they found the man trapped up to his waist in about 10 to 15 feet of corn.
That's Kevin Lyon, who's with MABAS, M-A-B-A-S, which stands for?
Mutual Aid Box Alarm System.
And when there's an emergency in small country towns, the responders are usually volunteers, and
they may have to leave the farm or the office or whatever, to get to the fire station, then respond to the scene.
And when the 911 call came in about the man buried to his waist in quicksand like corn inside a steel bin with temperatures over 100 degrees, the Sublette volunteers got on the phone to call in extra help, but they only had to make one phone call to MABAS.
MABAS is the statewide fire mutual aid coordinating agency to provide the coordination and the resource response for that.
And it's like that commercial, one call does it all.
Typically, these things do take multiple hours and involve a lot of people that have specialty training.
And it isn't just grain bins where the expertise comes in handy. Fires and accidents and countless other emergencies where volunteer departments need help, MABAS takes care of it. Okay, this one has a happy ending. The farmer was flown to a hospital where he was treated and sent home to sleep in his own bed that night. Yeah, if you were guessing the year 1970 and Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Ding, ding, ding!
On the food calendar, it's National Monte Cristo Day and National Apple Dumpling Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Dennis Rodkin, residential real estate reporter at Cranes, chicagobusiness.com. Your website and what you do is one of the sites I go to every single day, multiple times a day, preparing for Your Money Matters and the other programs here on WGN to get a sense of what's happening. I've read some stories of yours recently. I believe you and John have talked about, too, about how there have been some pretty lofty purchase prices for homes recently, eclipsing certain numbers that we hadn't seen before in a couple in a row. And then I see that there's a Streeterville penthouse asking $14.3 million, cutting the price in half. How do we square this circle, Dennis? What's happening with these big prices?
That's a property downtown.
So that's the difference.
Yeah, big difference between the downtown condo market and most of the rest of the market. A lot of those big high-end listings have been in Lincoln Park, Lake Forest. Downtown Chicago has been hit, continues to suffer from the 2020s, from the pandemic, from crime, from the slow return to work. The penthouse you're talking about is just a couple blocks away from us here. It's at 1 Bennett Park, which in 2019 put on the market three penthouses at the top. The least expensive of them on the 66th floor was over $14 million. That's 2019. 5 years later, just last week, the price has been cut before, but the new price cut took it to less than half. It's under $7 million. And this is for unfinished space.
Whoa.
As far as I know, the other two aren't sold. One went off the market, and the other is not in the records that I can access. But as far as I can tell, it hasn't sold. So there were three penthouses listed there at $14 million and up, $14 million to over $16 million. One of them is now back on the market at half price. This is, they're not the only building where this has happened. You saw in the story, I've written about several condos that have sold in recent months, not just in 2020, 21, 22, when things were really bad, but condos that have been selling for less than people paid in 2014, for less than people paid in 2010. Those are individual sellers, but the developers, the Tribune Tower, St. Regis, 1 Bennett Park, these downtown towers, their sales have been slower. Their prices in this case, you know, I'm a $14 million buyer. I'm much more likely these days to look at Lake Forest, Winnetka, than I am to look downtown. Mm. One developer told me this summer, we used to stake our high-end developments on the empty nester, the affluent empty nester from the northern suburbs, from the western suburbs, coming in to be downtown, eat on Rush Street, go to the theaters, all that sort of thing. But the climate has changed dramatically downtown. And regardless of whether you think crime is as bad as some people say it is true that these buyers say, I don't want to be there where there are these questions. And they're less likely to pick up a $14 million penthouse downtown than they are to pick up something in the suburbs.
I know it's hard to rile people up to be sad and feel bad for people that have to sell a right. penthouse for seven over 14. But if it's symptomatic of a larger issue and also then preventative of perhaps fixing that issue, we need and want residents to live downtown to funnel the funds and to keep the motivation there to keep it and make it better. I mean, it can be a sadder story for everyone else involved in the picture when these prices are cut in half.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody who buys a $14 million penthouse, first of all, again, remember, this is raw space. They're going to spend millions on finishing it out. And all that money does ripple through the economy. And their presence downtown ripples through the economy in other ways, whether they're going to restaurants and those kinds of things. Yeah, I know. Every time I write one of these stories about something selling at a big discount, somebody says, oh, boo-hoo, somebody didn't make multiple millions of dollars they expected.
You can just say, I said that. That's okay. You can name it. It was me.
But,
but
the truth is, you know, most of these prices were staked on expectations about where the economy was in downtown Chicago, what the appeal was of downtown Chicago. And so it's kind of a barometer. The fact that none of those three, as far as I can tell, at the top of 1 Bennett Park has sold, and several others, the Tribune Tower, when it opened, was its highest price was over $7 million. And as far as I can tell, the highest it has sold is at about $4.8 million. This is a barometer of what's happened to that idea of moving downtown. And as we've just discussed, there's also a question of how much money is going to ripple out through the economy.
It's interesting. Just a couple miles, even less than that in some cases, the difference between boom and bust for certain condos or even office developments. Look at downtown versus West Fulton, the Fulton Market District. Not that far away, right?
Like, yeah, Fulton Market's a great example. West Loop. Their condo market hasn't been affected the way places like Streeterville and Lakeshore East have, in large part because those high-end buyers aren't the affluent empty nester. They're young professional people who have worked their way up through the condo market. I bought for $500. I bought for $2 million. Now I'm buying a $5 million condo. I want to stay in the West Loop. And an example we have from that is Sulo, the developer that built very popular, very high-end buildings called Embry and Hayden in the West Loop and was selling condos at $4, $5, and $7 million, has just announced a third building or a third project in the West Loop in Fulton Market with over 200 condos. Wow. The idea over there is we can sell them. People want to be in the West Loop.
They're priced to be where it is, the size right, and the price is right.
Yeah, and all the right. population of buyers is slightly different.
And matches what the neighborhood is. Okay, we're out of time. Dennis Rockin, always interesting stuff. Crane, ChicagoBusiness.com. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, John.